The headlines, Iran says the U.S. should be held accountable for the losses it inflicted on Tehran by its illegal withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal. U.S. Republicans remain divided over supporting President Donald Trump's decision to fight for changing the election results. And the French Central Bank predicts a decline of up to 10% in the country's economic activity this year due to the newly imposed coronavirus lockdowns. Hello and welcome to your world news, coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran has ruled out any renegotiation regarding the 2015 nuclear agreement signed between Tehran and world powers. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said the agreement known as the JCPOA was the outcome of long-term talks between Iran, permanent members of the UN Security Council, and Germany. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the Iran nuclear deal is a binding international agreement and that no one can set conditions to renegotiate it. The spokesman said Washington has withdrawn from the accord and by doing so has inflicted losses to the Iranian nation. He said the U.S. should be held accountable for those losses. Activist and international lawyer Barry Grossman says Washington is seeking to renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal in order to decrease Israel's concerns.
Well, I think probably if you were to speak to the players privately, off the record, they would concede that talk of renegotiation is really quite absurd. And I guess what I would say is the way Mr. Biden, should he manage somehow to pull this from the fire, the way he deals with the Iran issue will be the acid test for the bona fides of his administration. Having said that, I think it's very important to keep in mind that he's already spoken and without reservation declared his commitment to Israel. And certainly the entire JCPO process and everything that's followed has in no small part been driven by Israel and its feigned concerns about Iran. So I personally don't hold out any great hope that Biden would be able to find the political will, let alone the capability to go against those very powerful interests that would have him continue to stay the course that's been steered by Donald Trump in order to reach a resolution with Iran. At the very least, I would expect there to be an attempt at a very serious renegotiation. And of course, as I understand it, Iran quite properly will not be a part of that.
U.S. President Donald Trump is planning to hold rallies to question the outcome of the vote that gave his Democratic rival Joe Biden a clean sweep in the race for the White House. A Trump campaign spokesman said the president wants to build support for his fight over the election results. The incumbent president has not acknowledged defeat and has launched an array of lawsuits to press claims of election fraud in swing states without producing any evidence. Trump has also lambasted the mainstream media for projecting Biden as a winner. That is, as President-elect Biden has taken the first steps to a transition plan into the White House. He and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris have launched a transition website that lists their four priorities: COVID-19, economic recovery, racial equality, and climate change. The transition website says Biden is assembling a team to tackle the challenges on day one when he formally takes office.
Democratic challenger Joe Biden has declared victory in the U.S. presidential election. The decision came after the Associated Press called the state of Pennsylvania for Biden, despite a lead of around 30,000 votes. Incumbent Donald Trump has refused to concede. The simple fact is, this election is far from over, Trump said in a statement released just minutes after NBC projected Biden to be the winner. Trump vowed that as soon as Monday, his team will start prosecuting our case in court to ensure election laws are fully upheld. He added his observers were not allowed into the counting rooms and said he won the election, getting 71 million legal votes. But Biden supporters celebrated around the country anyway. The use of mail-in ballots has already provided months of controversy and made this an election which is counted unlike any other. Many Republican supporters contested their validity and in huge numbers rejected using them. Democrats say fraud has not been proven, but analysts say that seems like something the courts may ultimately be forced to decide when the votes are finally counted. Biden's declaration of victory before all the votes are counted in this very narrow and very divisive election may anger many of Trump's 70 million voters. They may continue to insist that the judicial branch fully vet this very unique election and not drop their hundreds of ongoing lawsuits. Trump himself has spread allegations of electoral fraud in key states, despite repeated pushback from election officials and judges in numerous court cases. As vote tallies in crucial states appeared to be favoring Biden in the days after Election Day, Trump even demanded that states stop counting ballots. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
While U.S. media declared Joe Biden the winner of the presidential election, many Republicans remain divided whether to call the race over. Few within the Republican Party, including former President George Bush, congratulated Joe Biden's triumph in the election. However, most Republicans have remained silent and avoided congratulating Biden's victory. They keep supporting President Donald Trump, saying that he should keep fighting for changing the election results. Trump plans to legally challenge the election results. He accused Democrats of stealing the vote results and election meddling in swing states. The European Union presses ahead with plans to impose tariffs on up to $4 billion worth of U.S. goods and services. The EU's top trade official says the tariffs will be imposed over illegal American support for plane maker Boeing. Last year, the World Trade Organization authorized the U.S. to slap penalties on EU goods worth up to $7.5 billion. It was over European support for Boeing rival Airbus. Now the EU says it remains open for a negotiated solution for both sides to withdraw their tariffs. Trade tensions have been mounting between the U.S. and the European Union over the past couple of years, with the Trump administration trying to reduce the U.S. trade deficits through tariffs. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, who is with us live from Brussels. Jerome, if you could please tell us more about the different aspects of this.
Well, the European Commission has always said that it remains and stands ready to withdraw new tariffs that it imposes once the United States does the same, because it's saying that it's only reciprocating what the U.S. is doing. And, you know, of course, all of this is happening against the backdrop of the change in the administration. And I think there can be little doubt that when Joe Biden gets into office next year, that things will normalize and relations will improve. This is such an important foreign policy issue for the European Union, for any country, really. I mean, it's the most important foreign policy issue when we're talking about trade, apart from security, if you're being threatened by another country or whatever. But, you know, this is because this is all the money is involved here for the European Union. And, of course, it's a big issue for the United States. So I think what will happen is, you know, the EU side wants no tariffs with the US. They want a trade deal with the United States. And I think it is quite possible now, with Joe Biden coming into power, that we're going to see a situation whereby in the coming couple of years, we could have a trade deal between the EU and the US. So this is sort of a sideshow in a way. The European Commission, you know, has to take an official position that Trump's administration is still in power, that it will be in power for the next until January. So, you know, it's going to maintain its current trajectory until such time as Trump leaves the White House, and then things will improve. There is concern, however, if you look at what, you know, officials here, the European Commission, are saying, there is concern, of course, that, you know, Trump still has executive powers, considerable executive powers, that he could implement in the intervening period between now and when Joe Biden takes over. And that is a concern. I mean, what is Trump capable of in terms of using those executive powers on a whole range of different issues? So there is concern in that regard. But there's also the wider trade issue here. I mean, if you look at a situation, Trump during his tenure, he has created a situation whereby the European Union has been sort of restricted from trading with other jurisdictions. I mean, look at the potential that there is to trade with Iran, for example, population of more than 80 million people. And there are companies, I mean, you mentioned Boeing, you mentioned Airbus, the likes of Airbus, a huge company, it wants to sign contracts with Iran. We saw that when we had the Iran nuclear deal, it was being implemented before Trump came along, and contracts were being signed, not only with Airbus, but also with Boeing and with other major manufacturers. And there is a hope, of course, and these companies, it's not just the European Union, but individual companies, they know that Iran is such a big market, they know that there's so much potential there to make money and to generate trade. And so there is this hope that once Trump is out of the White House, and hopefully that things are, you know, that the restrictions, the illegal sanctions on Iran are reduced, and this intimidation that he's tried to do by trying to bully companies not to trade with Iran, and bully countries as well right around the world not to trade with Iran, hopefully that will be normalized. So this is a wider issue. It's not just trade between the EU and the US, but this particular dispute you're talking about has been going on for almost two decades. It relates to, you know, the EU giving subsidies to Airbus, which you know, the US claimed gave unfair competition in terms of the aviation industry, and likewise the EU accused the United States of doing the same with Boeing. But I think this is all going to that will be resolved very quickly once Biden's in the White House.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, live from Brussels. Now, the coronavirus pandemic has badly hit the European economy. France is one of the countries suffering from recession due to the pandemic-related lockdowns. We discuss this issue with our guests. Let's take a listen. In this edition of the News Review, the French Central Bank predicts a decline of up to 10% in the country's economic activity in 2020. The plunge, which is bigger than previously expected, results from a newly imposed COVID-19 restriction. The central bank estimates that the nation's gross domestic product will contract 12% compared to a normal week in November. Services requiring direct contact with customers are expected to be the hardest hit, with a 40% decline in their services. The new restrictions came into effect on October 30th to curb the coronavirus surge in France. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent in Paris, Kristen Hund, and also Dr. Steve Keen, author of Debunking Economics out of Bangkok. Thanks to both of you gentlemen. Let's start with our correspondent in Paris to give us an update. Can you tell us more about the different aspects of this piece of news that we have received?
Well, the figures of the central bank are minus 10% economic growth for the entire year 2020, which confirms former forecast of the INSEE, which is the National Institute of Statistics. They preview minus 10%, even minus 13%. All this is due to the severe measures taken due to the second wave of the coronavirus. So there is a second lockdown, which is rather severe. And affects mostly bars, restaurants, hotels, and also recreation sectors. However, the difference with the first wave, the first lockdown earlier this year, is that schools, primary and secondary schools, remain open. That allows parents to go to work with a focus on work at home. So it means that other sectors like construction and public services are less affected. However, a negative growth of minus 10%, it's really huge, and there is an unemployment rate of plus 10%, and poverty is really rising at this moment.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to Mr. Keane from Bangkok. Mr. Keane, did European governments, and France in particular, have better choices or better options, say, economically speaking, in order to not to put so much pressure on the economy?
Well, no, in a word, because this disease spreads by human contact, as we know, particularly in enclosed environments with low circulation of air. Now, of course, you know, you've got Europe going into winter right now. That is almost the definition of a European workplace. And the only way to prevent it is to enable people not to suffer from the financial consequences, that the government has to provide cash flow that enables people who are not working in essential tasks not to work but still not go bankrupt because of that. But you really have to shut down most of the forms of economic activity which involve people congregating indoors in badly aerated environments.
But Mr. Keane, the reason why I'm asking you is this, is that we've seen other countries not taking such drastic measures, even in Europe, Sweden, for example, and their economy is quite fine, and on the other hand, they don't have that many severe coronavirus cases either.
That's not true. Sweden, when you take a look at the level of the fall in GDP versus the number of deaths and the number of recorded cases, Sweden is at the high end of both in terms of the economic impact. People, if the government doesn't tell you to lock down, but you still know you have a 1 in 20 chance of getting a disease which can kill you if you're the right age group, you don't go out, you don't go to work. So there's an internal tendency for people not to lock down. To lock down, even if the government tells them, don't worry. I'm currently in Thailand because Thailand executed a very intelligent process of lockdown of all except essential activities, which really means people producing food, electricity, and the internet. And as a result of that, a country of 65 million has had less than 4,000 cases. And is now back to pretty much normal activity, except for the absence of international tourism. So you simply have to do a lockdown while we still don't have an effective vaccine, and you have to do an effective lockdown. Anything which is half-baked, particularly during winter in Europe, is going to end up with just as many cases after it within a matter of weeks, given how contagious this virus is.
Thank you very much. Back to Chris, our correspondent in Paris. Now, Chris, as we just heard our other guests from Bangkok, obviously the French government has no other choice, but how do you think this economic impact can be less severe?
The main problem with the French government is they did not apply a massive testing in the beginning of the COVID crisis. And now, as it is too late, they postponed as far as possible the second measures of the due to the second wave, though, so a second lockdown, but due to the massive casualties in patients and also deaths, I mean, last 24 hours, 60,000 new cases, it's a new record, 306 new deaths due to the COVID crisis, the French government has been obliged to apply the second lockdown measures and is thinking about even making it more severe. The reason why the French government is not making it more severe is a fear, panic of an economic bankrupt. So that's the reason why the second lockdown is less severe than the first lockdown, to permit the main economic activities. But as it is going this way, they will be obliged to take new, more severe measures.
Thank you very much, Dr. Steve Keane, author of Debunking Economics out of Bangkok, and our correspondent, Kristen Hund, out of Paris. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your elaborations, and thanks to all of you for following this edition of the News Review. And now, with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will explore how people and government of India see and react to the normalization of relations with Israel.
The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have formally established diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime in deals brokered and promulgated by the US President Donald Trump. Palestinians have decried the move as a grave betrayal to the people and cause of Palestine, saying that formalizing ties with the Zionist regime further undermines efforts to achieve self-determination. However, the American president says that there are several other Arab states that are willing to go public with their Israeli affairs.
Some Arab countries are formally normalizing their relations with Israel. Most Muslims around the world are against it, and there are regular protests against the move in numerous countries, whether the respective governments support it or not. Evidently, the Indian government supports it, which is quite against the common spirit of the majority of the people in the subcontinent, and not only the Muslims.
It's despicable, sad, condemnable, unfortunate. And whatever we can say about this relation between Arab and Israel is beyond words.
As far as Indian Muslims are concerned, they have already expressed their strong condemnation about the recent normalization of the ties between Israel and UAE.
If you talk about Indian perspective, not just the Indian Muslims, but the Indian people at large have been and will always be with the Palestinian cause and have always condemned Israel and its aggression.
U.S. President Donald Trump was the force behind the agreement for the UAE and Bahrain to establish normal diplomatic relations with Israel. The day after Trump announced the deal, UAE Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan briefed Indian External Affairs Minister Subrahmanyam Jaishankar about the move in a telephone call that the minister really appreciated. The timing of the proclamation seems suspiciously beneficial for Trump's re-election, as both Israel and UAE want him back in the White House. Trump wants to sell the agreement as a diplomatic victory in his campaign and tries to brand it Abraham Accord, as Abraham was father of all three great faiths.
The agreement is a part of a broader re-election show by Trump and his administration, who earlier this year revealed the so-called Middle East peace plan, which was categorically rejected by the Palestinians as well as other countries of the region. Even if Trump loses the elections, UAE is not likely to face any major diplomatic repercussions, as the Democratic hopeful Joe Biden has also welcomed the deal, cluelessly calling it a historic step to bridge the deep divides of the Middle East.
Some Arab states of the Persian Gulf had already established covert ties with Israel, so why is now the time to risk and go public about them? The UAE and Bahrain are the third and fourth Arab state after Egypt and Jordan to have opened diplomatic lines. If Abu Dhabi and Manama do not face any serious consequences, the move may serve as a catalyst for other states to follow suit. Trump has even more re-election stunts on his list and is pushing more countries such as Sudan and Oman toward Israel. India's reaction to the agreement is not surprising, as all the three nations behind the move have become close partners of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi government. Israel and India have enjoyed close relations in recent years, and Modi has also been able to cultivate strong relations with the UAE. India sees this as a potentially positive sign, as the normalization may create a more favorable political environment for its interests in the Middle East.
Now, to add more insight, we are joined by Mr. Vijay Prasad, who is a historian, journalist, and director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. He's also the author of the book Namaste Sharon, Hindutva and Sharonism Under U.S. Hegemony. Mr. Prasad, welcome to the subcontinent. So, in the past few decades, there have been many reports exposing Arab-Israeli back-channel links. Why have they decided to formalize their relations now?
You see, now, and when you talk about Arab, you mean mainly the United Arab Emirates. And we need to understand that there is an increased tension between the UAE and Turkey over a range of issues. On the one side, their battle over Libya. On the other side, their battle over gas fields in the Eastern Mediterranean. Turkey and the UAE have been struggling with each other over certain resources and regions in the greater North African, West Asian region. I have a feeling that the UAE, seeking to get European and American backing for its project, essentially normalized with Israel as a way to curry favor and therefore to put pressure on Turkey. There's no way the UAE can confront Turkey directly. So this is a way to get diplomatic favor in Washington, D.C., perhaps in Paris and so on, and allow that pressure to be put on Turkey so that Turkey backs off in, you know, on the one side in Libya and on the other side in the very important energy battles taking place in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Okay, you're focusing on UAE, but Bahrain has also normalized relations with Israel recently, and Oman is in the pipeline. And you're saying that India is supporting this move because it wants to put pressure on Turkey and gain favors from the U.S. So does the Indian government support the normalization of relations between Israel and Arab states?
It's hard to say whether the Indian government directly supports the normalization, because India, as you know, plays a double game here. On the one hand, India has normalized with Israel and started that process in 91-92. On the other hand, India is a little careful, even under the Narendra Modi government, of two direct statements regarding the issue of Palestine or Israel, so as not to jeopardize relations mainly with Saudi Arabia, because there's a feeling that Saudi Arabia, a big energy provider to India, might not like it if India is too much public about its support for Israel. So India generally keeps a sort of double game here and hasn't come out directly and said we support the UAE or we don't support the UAE. I mean, in that sense, silence on this is to India's benefit.
Now, Mr. Prasad, our team has collected global media coverages in this regard, and we would like you to take a look on that, and then we can continue with the question and answer session.
Historic as this moment is, it's worth looking at the larger geopolitical forces at work here and the short-term and long-term calculations of the key players involved. In the Machiavellian world of the Middle East, nothing is as clear-cut as it first appears. That's why it's also important that India play its cards carefully as it comes to terms with a changing Middle East. The fog over the emerging realignments in the region has officially lifted. India's strategic partnership with Israel, Saudi Arabia, and UAE is a major pillar of India's relationship with the West Asian region. This partnership will be strengthened. With India's growing ties to the US, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and UAE, and ties with Iran and Turkey floundering over the Kashmir issue, the agreement will buttress Delhi's ties with the region.
Thank you for staying with us, Mr. Prasad, and welcome back to the audience as well. So, Mr. Prasad, you earlier said that India is playing a double game. How can the Indian government support the Palestinian cause and Israel at the same time? Isn't it hypocritical? How is it possible?
To support the Palestinian cause and to support Israel at the same time is simply not possible, because in a sense, the Israeli project is about the annihilation of the Palestinian project. So you can't support both, I'm afraid. In this case, one has to make a choice. And India has effectively chosen to stand with Israel in terms of the Israel colonization of the Palestinian people, their life and land and so on. India has made a choice, but it doesn't want to too publicly declare that choice, even though it's made the choice. You know, so there'll be some small gestures vis-a-vis the Palestinians. The Indians will go and say, we'll invest in some project in the Palestinian Authority and so on. Small gestures will be made, But by and large, I think India, like many of the Gulf Arab countries, have made their choice and they have decided to stand with Israel against the Palestinian people.
So you're saying that India has made a choice and sided with Israel. So has India abandoned its Gandhian values?
Time ago that Gandhi, Nehru and others made clear their support for the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause. You know, that was the era of anti-colonialism and struggles, and in a sense what the Palestinians were facing, what they were struggling with, was the struggle of anti-colonialism. You know, they wanted to free themselves from colonialism. This lasts all the way out till the 1980s in India, this support for the anti-colonial struggle. Yasser Arafat, for instance, comes to Delhi in 1983, is met at the airport by Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister. He says that she is my sister. I mean, you know, they were very close relations. The Palestinian Liberation Organization had an office in Delhi. But after India decided to normalize with the United States, actually, first, it was told you have to normalize with Israel. And that is the big shift. When the Soviet Union collapses, it was catastrophic for non-aligned policy. It was catastrophic for third world solidarity. It was catastrophic for the Palestinians. I mean, the PLO went and surrendered, essentially, at Oslo, during the Oslo Accords, those agreements. So, you know, it's not just India that surrendered its support for the Palestinians, but the PLO also in some ways surrendered its own views at Oslo. And that was a sign of the times. And sadly, a new kind of international support for the Palestinian cause has not been properly built up. This is greatly lacking.
Out of more than 190 member states of the United Nations, nearly 140 recognize the state of Palestine, and about 160 also recognize Israel. This means a lot of the governments in the world have relations with both the occupier and the occupied. But when Arab countries connive with the US to establish former ties with the Zionist regime, many other countries feel emboldened to defend their Israeli ties.
India's official stand about Israel has always been somehow paradoxically, yet conveniently supple. In 2014, India chose to pursue a de-hyphenation policy aiming to deal with both Israel and Palestine in an independent manner. In 2017, India voted against recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and then again in 2018, New Delhi decided to review its Palestine policy when the Palestinian ambassador to Pakistan was photographed, along with the chief of Lashkar-e-Taiba, a militant group blamed for the 2008 Mumbai siege. While Palestine calls this a betrayal that blows up every possibility for peace, India welcomes the full normalization of ties between UAE and Israel, calling both key strategic partners. New Delhi says it still continues its traditional support for the Palestinian cause. But how? It seems that the Middle East has more than enough sand for everybody to bury their heads in. Otherwise, the world would notice such inconsistent and constantly changing policies. Israel, UAE, and the US claim the normalization is an exchange of Tel Aviv suspending its annexation of Palestinian territories. But from the Palestinian point of view, the UAE and Bahrain have destroyed any hopes of establishing an independent state with this move that can never slow Israeli expansionism.
This step is very dangerous step because it will encourage some other countries in order to normalize their relation with Israel, which is not normal, which is against our religion, which is against our history.
Palestine belongs to the Arabs in the same sense that England belongs to the English or France to the French. This Mahatma Gandhi's 1938 remark about Palestine is the most quoted utterance in any literature of India's foreign policy. The first blow to Gandhian values was in 1992, when India reversed its four-decade-old policy of recognition without relations and normalized relations with the Israeli regime. Now, with India's support for the normalization of ties with Israel, Gandhi's statement that Palestine belongs to the Arabs is further losing its relevance.
Several pundits believe it is not surprising, not even a big deal, that a number of Arab countries are going public with their previously covert ties with Israel, as some others, including India, stand and applaud. Formalized relations with Israel probably guarantee garnering bipartisan favor with the United States. And the U.S. approval means a green light for authoritarian governments to suppress all different voices and domestic challenges with less chance of international pressure. Thanks to formalizing relations with Israel, Bahrain's Al Khalifa family have acquired an influential ally in its fight against domestic opposition. This can also be true for Saudi Arabia, which is still gauging the prospects of normalization. Since Riyadh seeks to nip the bud for political liberalization that would challenge the legitimacy of the ruling Al-Saud monarchy, including demands for change from its own repressed Shia minority. The Indian government longs for such an opportunity. India has compelling reasons to feel optimistically comfortable, but its open support for Israeli relations may put its own interests and dealings at stake in the Middle East. If New Delhi puts all its eggs in the Arab basket, Islamabad may align itself more closely with Tehran and Ankara, all in the backdrop of growing Iran-China and Pakistan-Iran ties.
For more analysis, we are now joined by Dr. Tasleem Ahmed Rahmani, who is the President of Muslim Political Council of India and the National Secretary of Social Democratic Party of India. Dr. Rahmani, welcome to the show. So, how do the Indian people, especially the 200 million Muslims, view these Arab countries formalizing ties with Israel?
You see, the Indian Muslims are traditionally and historically against the Israel and with standing always with the Palestinian cause. Still, the general public, and there is no change in their standing, their policy towards Palestine and towards Israel. We have always taken Israel as a traitor country, as an occupier, and as a terrorist state. And we still, at our public level, general public level, we still owe that stand, and we very vociferously. We are here to boycott the Israeli product, and our Union government still towards the pro-Israeli policy is being strongly condemned by the Indian Muslims because we take it as an occupier.
Okay, so you're saying that people side with the Palestinian cause and condemn the support of the Indian government for Israel. India has strong economic ties with Arab countries. Do you see this as a weight on the Indian government to support Arab normalization with Israel?
Yes, indeed. You see the change in India. It's a fascist regime. We always termed it as a fascist regime, as a saffronized and a right-wing radicalized political party is the BJP. And after the BJP has taken over, they have just opened up their relationship with Israel. Most of our security installations, our business ties, economic ties, agriculture sector, power sector, telecommunication sector, the government of India has a big tie-up with the Israeli government. And ideologically, this BJP, RSS, and Israel policy has an affinity in they stand at the same pedestal. That's why the strong bonding between India and Israel has repercussions on the Indo-Arab relationship. So as far as the Arab countries are coming closer to Israel, the India is also becoming closer to those Muslim countries or Arab countries which are coming closer to Israel. That's why they praise UAE, they praise Saudi Arabia, some of such Gulf countries. While this is a fact that our relationship, as far as our foreign policy is concerned, our relation with Saudi Arabia was not very cordial. It was just a normal relationship we always maintained with Saudi Arabia and other such Gulf countries. But after this change in regime and the shift in foreign policy, these relationship has become more cordial just because of the relationship with Israel are coming more, the diplomatic relation is coming more closer with those Gulf rulers. That's obviously the government of India has taken a step towards them, and they have made their bonding much more stronger just because of Israel.
Now, Dr. Rahmani, let's just quickly take a look at how global media has covered this issue, and then we can continue with the question.
In late November 2019, there was widespread outrage over a video of the Indian Consul General in New York, Sandeep Chakravorty, in which he suggested to a gathering of Kashmiri Hindus that India should follow the Israeli model and build settlements in the Kashmir Valley to secure the return of Hindus. Kashmiri activists and journalists were shocked by his apparent support for Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. But this is only one of many recent examples of a growing political love affair between India and Israel. Retired Indian Foreign Service officer Navdeep Suri, who had been India's ambassador to UAE until late 2019, has told The Wire that the trends towards the normalization of ties between Israel and UAE had been clearly discernible in the last couple of years as the two were driven by their joint antipathy towards Iran.
All right, Dr. Rahmani, welcome back to the show. So you're saying that the Indian government loves Israel and is therefore supporting the Arab countries who are formalizing their relations with the Israeli regime. India has a history of supporting Palestinian cause. Has anything changed there in India with this regard?
You see, Gandhian values, Gandhi, Congress, and Muslims, and so many other groups like the liberals, the communists, social organizations, they were always pro-Palestine, pro-Gandhian. This regime, and particularly this ideology, RSS pose, they claim today that they are actually the Gandhian. While they do not belong to Gandhi or Gandhi philosophy, they are actually the killers of Gandhi, and not only the killer of Gandhi, they are the killer of Gandhian ideology. But because Gandhi is a tallest icon in our nation, and no regime can go further without taking the name of Gandhi. That's why the present establishment tried to show that they are also Gandhian, and that's why otherwise they have nothing to do with Gandhi or Gandhi philosophy actually. So there is a shift in the Israel and Palestine policy, but that doesn't mean that the Gandhi or Gandhi ideology has tilted towards that policy. This is a fraud and this is a cross that this RSS and BJP try to pose that they are also Gandhian. No, they are not Gandhians. They take advantage of, but you must understand that the general public, the normal population of India, they are pro-Palestinian till today. There is not a single day goes by when we don't find a report, a positive report about Palestine in our print media, particularly the Urdu media. There is not a single day pass when we don't have a report about the Gaza people, about the Hamas people, about the plights of Palestine. So the general population, and not only Muslim, rather the social groups, the secularist groups, they are still standing with the Palestine in the same way we used to stand before 2014, but this regime was against Palestine even before coming to the power. They are still against Palestine. They will remain against Palestine always because they are right-winger radicalized people.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode covering the issue of normalization of ties with the Zionist regime and India's stance towards it. We'll meet next week.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Allah. first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam by Tahir Reza Jafar.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Welcome to another episode of For Humanity, a program in which we look at the Treatise of Rights or Risalatul Huquq that comes to us from our fourth Imam, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. We have been discussing the right of the one who is asked, Haqqul Mas'ul. As we know, when we try and imagine the process of giving charity, there are two parties involved. One is the asker or the beggar, and the other one is the one who is asked or the giver. Without these two parties, there can be no charity. And so the Imam alayhi salam in Risalatul Huquq discusses the rights of both these parties. He discusses the right of the beggar, the one who is asking, and he discusses the right of the one who is being asked. And while talking about the process of asking and giving, we find that the Imam alayhi salam reminds us of many other aspects that need to be kept in mind. For example, in the traditions we find certain very important reminders aimed at the mas'ul, aimed at the one who is asked, to remind him about how difficult it is for the beggar to ask. So for example, in one tradition we find that we are told, Al-mas'alatu tawqul madhallah تسلب العزيز عزة والحسيب حسبه. We are told that asking and begging is like the chain around a person's neck that makes him humble, that makes him abased, that humiliates him. This act of asking takes away the glory and the majesty and the respect and the honor and the dignity of one who has all these things. And it takes away the honor and the status of one who has status. So basically what this tradition is telling us is that when somebody comes to ask you, remember that by asking you, he is humiliating himself, he is abasing himself. And so you should not add insult to injury. You should not put salt on his wound by treating him in a very harsh way. Do not be harsh with the beggar, with the one who asks, because already he has put his respect on the line by asking you. And in another tradition from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says, الذُلُّ فِي مَسْأَلَةِ النَّاسِ. Humiliation lies in asking people. When you ask people for anything, for financial assistance, for any other favor, the moment you ask someone for something, you have opened the door of humiliation. That person now has power over you. They can humiliate you. They can abase you. So it is very important, therefore, to realize that as much as possible, you need to avoid asking. But at the same time, when you are being asked, you should keep this in mind, that the person who is asking has really abased himself, has really humiliated himself. So you should treat him with kindness. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam tells us that we should avoid ever putting ourselves in a position where we humiliate ourselves. He says, Inna Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala
فوض إلى المؤمن كل شيء إلا إذلال نفسه. He says Allah Azza wa Jal has given a believer the choice to do whatever he wishes except to humiliate himself. It is very important, therefore, to realize that the process of asking entails self-humiliation and should be thus avoided. And so Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when talking about the dignity and respect of human beings, he says, مَنْ لَمْ يَصُنْ وَجْهَهُ عَنْ مَسْأَلَتِكَ فَأَكْرِمْ وَجْهَكَ عَنْ رَدِّهِ. He says, O you who are being asked, you are the mas'ool, you are being asked, if the person who comes to ask you has not protected his respect and his dignity, and he has asked you, then you protect your respect and your dignity by not denying him. What a beautiful tradition. It talks about the importance of preserving one's respect. And when you turn away the beggar, you are yourself putting your own respect in danger. For obviously, when people see you misbehaving or being rude or unkind to beggars, then they would have a negative impression of you. They would have a negative opinion about you, and you would then end up losing your respect. In another tradition, again, we are told, لَا تَرُدَّ السَّائِلَ وَصُنْ مُرُوَّتَكَ عَنْ حِرْمَانِهِ. Do not deprive or turn away the beggar or the one who is asking you. Rather, protect your magnanimity from depriving him. A magnanimous person is one who gives, who supports, who is benevolent, who is kind. But if a person does not have these qualities, then they are not counted as having magnanimity. They are not magnanimous people. And to be a magnanimous person means that you have great respect in the community. People adore you, people respect you. So it is important to give those who ask in order to preserve your respect and your magnanimity. And in another tradition from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says, أُبْذُلْ مَالَكَ لِمَنْ بَذَلَ وَجْهَهُ لَكَ فَإِنَّ بَذْلَ الْوَجْهِ لَا يُوَازِيهِ شَيْءٍ. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, give your wealth to the one who has given up his dignity in front of you by asking you. For indeed, there is no amount that you can give such a person that would help him recover something as valuable as his dignity. And so from these traditions, we realize that as people who are being asked, we should always consider that the person who is asking us has put himself in a very precarious position, so we should treat them with kindness and mercy. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, we hope you enjoyed the program For Humanity by Brother Taher Reza Jafar. If you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
O mountains of Mecca, bear witness that I to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that he's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is his messenger.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.